This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 20 years ago, Coldwater native Scott Brayton was to start in the pole position at the Indianapolis 500 for the second consecutive year. But the race car driver was killed in an accident during practice before that year's race. Coming up, Battle Creek Inquirer sports columnist Bill Broderick tells us how Brayton is remembered by his family and race fans. But first, Kalamazoo doctor and author Ken Fisher has joined us before to discuss end-of-life care, new ideas for health care reform, and his new e-book takes a longer view of the healthcare system. His book is called Understanding Healthcare, A Historical Perspective. Ken Fisher, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure being here, Gordon. It's always fun talking with you.
Why did you want to take this look at healthcare through the lens of history?
Well, because I wanted to show people how difficult it is to change ideas. Once an idea gets established, it's very hard to change it. The second reason was I wanted to show that the scientific revolution that was started by Copernicus and Vesalius in the 1500s led to people to look at issues in medicine, and that the giants of the 19th century, Virchow and Pasteur and everything, started the real revolution in medicine based on science and knowledge, instead of superstition. And then how the AMA got started by people who were on the right side of history, understood science. And then how people got off track and has led to total confusion and complexity, which nobody understands. So that's why I wrote the book.
Can you explain a little bit more about that idea of science and medicine merging together and the process under which that happened?
Sure. I spend a good deal of time talking about that. Chapter 1 explains that two doctors, Copernicus and Vesalius, Copernicus, who we all know was a great astronomer, and really laid the groundwork for the idea that the Earth is not the center of the solar system, but the sun is, which was a radical idea at the time. But he used data, and he created a hypothesis and then tested his hypothesis. So in the first chapter, I talk about the scientific method. And Vesalius was a surgeon and an anatomist, and he refuted Galen's idea, an ancient Roman, actually Greek physician to Roman emperors. And he had written an anatomy book, which was followed for over 1,000 years. The only problem was he didn't dissect humans. He dissected ox. And so his book was wrong. And this went on for over 1,000 years. And then Vesalius published, and they both published the same year. I believe it was 1543, but it's in the book. I'm not sure exactly when. And then that led to thinking that, and then the Enlightenment came with the idea, well, people have minds and they can think. So let's try to think our way through things instead of just accepting dogma. And the great breakthrough came in the late 1700s and the 1800s with Jenner, with smallpox vaccination, Pasteur, Virchow, and I go through a whole list. It's not complete, of these really giant minds that laid the foundation for scientific medicine.
One of the other important milestones you talk about is when mental health began to be considered along with physical health.
Exactly. And that is our old friend Sigmund Freud, who again did his work in the late 1800s. So the 19th century is really the foundation of modern medicine. And then medicine before then was not a big deal. You had as much chance dying being treated by a doctor as you had of surviving. So, and then as science moved forward, it's very interesting. Most of this was happening in Europe. And as the colonies got developed into a country, there was very few educated doctors in the European style, where they had to go to college and then learn medicine, et cetera, et cetera. It was more of an apprenticeship model. And that's where Nathan Smith Davis came in, who founded the American Medical Association and said, no, this is, although he was trained that way, he recognized this is not right.
And we eventually got medical schools.
Exactly.
Which also changed the game, right?
That's right. Well, yes and no. Not initially. Yes, the University of Pennsylvania was the first medical school, and then I list the beginning medical schools, 4, 5, 6. But it turns out they could never meet the need. There were so few they could never meet the need. And as the population of America grew way beyond anybody's expectations, there started to be proprietary medical schools where 2, 3, 4 doctors would set up a medical school. They'd charge for a lecture. You'd stay there for 3, 5, 6 months. You'd apprentice with one of them. And after a year or something, you're now a doctor.
And they were sort of running this as a side business.
That's right.
Right.
And it was and those were most of the doctors in the United States. And it was actually these gentlemen in the AMA who believed they were on the right side of history because they believed that you needed both science and the ability to understand people, that it was a deep human connection that provided good medicine, which was based on the fundamentals of science, but you always had to adjust the fundamentals to the individual person. And so this was a major issue. And then it took all kinds of efforts to convince people that this was the way to go. And that actually the founding, the big step in that was the Flexner Report, which after a while closed all these proprietary medical schools. And this was AMA-driven, American Medical Association-driven, which closed all the proprietary medical schools, and then the university medical schools flourished. The best example was probably the founding of Johns Hopkins, which was actually founded by 4 women, Johns Hopkins Medical School, who gave the money to create the school and demanded that women have equal admission criteria as men. And Johns Hopkins and then the graduates of Johns Hopkins from this university-style medical school got jobs in other medical schools, and the Johns Hopkins model of a research university became paramount.
So as you say, the American Medical Association was on the right side of history, in your view, for a very long time.
Right.
Where is the point where you would say they started to slip and get on the wrong side of history?
It's a very interesting question. In the early 1900s, the AMA and its leaders were quite concerned about the health of the entire population. And part of their prestige was pushing public health and public health initiatives. Very forward-thinking, and in large part led by their founder, Nathan Smith Davis, who was a giant of an intellect. And he was the dean of the founding schools of Northwestern University. It wasn't started as Northwestern University Medical School for over 30 years. And he was also the founder of the Northwestern Law School. I mean, this guy was out of sight. So these people were very concerned. There was a major switch, and the major switch came around 1920. Although they were correct in saying this bond between physician and patient is critically important for good medicine, they got tied up with the fact that they didn't want any other interference. So they were totally – at first, they were totally against insurance. But they finally went with that. But they fought government subsidies for insurance. They were afraid that the government would get into the exam room, which has actually happened. So they were so concerned about that that their minds were frozen. And they couldn't say, well, why can't the government just subsidize people so that they can go out and get their own care? It never dawned on them. They were so adamant about this. So from 1920 to 1965, they fought everything. They were on the wrong side of history.
You say, though, throughout the book that they didn't have counterproposals.
That's right.
They were fighting everybody else's ideas, but never really coming up with something of their own to say, here's another way of doing it.
That's right. They never came up with a middle-of-the-ground solution. You know, something that would, one, maintain the physician-patient intense relationship, yet on the other hand, for people who can't afford that kind of thing, to be able to support them in some way that could continue to happen. And by not proposing an alternative, they, in essence, their greatest fears came about.
Do you see any parallel between that situation and today? I mean, people who have heard you interviewed on this station, other places,
sure,
know you do not like the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare.
That's right.
But is there a lack of a real alternative out there that's in the public sphere anyway, or in the public square being debated about what might be done instead?
Yes, there is. The idea to me is that every person should have the ability to obtain excellent care. And that's really in society's interest. You know, a lot of people say you should do it from a moral point of view, and that's probably true. But it's also in society's interest that everybody be as healthy as possible. So how is a way to do that that can be done and maintain that relationship with the physician and a patient and not put the country into bankruptcy, as is happening? And of course there is a way. And it's been shown in other countries, in Switzerland and in Hong Kong. And it's also been shown in Indiana, with the poorest of the poor. Indiana, Mitch Daniels, when he was governor, initiated a plan where a certain group of Medicaid patients would receive a payment each year into a health savings account, which they could then use to go see a physician of their choice and pay that physician a reasonable amount. They also provided for these people insurance for catastrophic events. So the real idea of insurance, we have morphed health insurance actually into prepaid health care. It's not really insurance. Insurance for your house is if it burns down, but insurance doesn't pay if you paint it. And your car insurance. So people are familiar with the idea of real insurance. If you need an oil change, you don't call up the insurance company to try to get an oil change. So Mitch Daniels did this, and it worked beautifully. So there are instances, and now direct primary care is growing, where people pay a primary care doctor $50, $60, $70 a month, depending on how many family members and this, that, and the other thing. And that's growing. So there is something out there, but it's very difficult for the majority of people to understand this.
Okay. We talked about health savings accounts the last time you were here.
Yeah,
and
right.
I guess, recommend people maybe go to that interview, which is on our website, if they want
sure.
a more detailed breakdown of that. One thing I did not ask you last time that I probably should have, the idea you mentioned that people could on their own get health savings accounts and then high deductible insurance plans.
Sure.
But you also said that you wouldn't want to require anybody to do that.
Right.
Would those high deductible insurance plans be eligible to someone with a pre-existing condition, or could they be denied by a pre-existing condition?
Well, not now, because I think that's one part of the Affordable Care Act that is positive. In Chapter 10, I cover this in detail, and I make it a voluntary thing. In other words, why shouldn't Americans have a choice?
And you say health savings accounts would be one choice on top of the others that we have, right?
Yes. So people could choose. But to make it work, we have to change the IRS code a little bit and expand health savings accounts so that they can pay for a direct primary care doctor or a direct doctor. And we can talk about that, how there really isn't a doctor shortage. We'll talk about that. and can pay for their high deductible plan. So the idea of a health savings account, I think, has to be expanded if it's going to be widely used.
The reason I ask about the pre-existing conditions is because one of the arguments for the individual mandate is you can't just have people buying insurance after
Absolutely.
They get sick or after they're in a car accident. So if somebody doesn't get this high deductible plan, you know, do we allow them to come in and buy insurance after they get a cancer diagnosis, for instance?
Sure. I think that's a very reasonable question. I think the idea that I'm trying to get people to understand is you would have a health savings account for your child. As soon as your child's born, you start putting money into the health savings account, and that's a tax credit.
Right, which the number you gave last time was $2,000 a
right.
year. With a chronic disease, though, you could spend $2,000 quick.
No question. So, but you have a high deductible plan the day you're born with this idea. So you are enrolled in a high deductible plan.
Along with your health savings account.
Exactly.
They're tied together, in other
That's
words.
Right. That's right. And even today, you can't open a health savings account without a high deductible plan. You can't have one.
And you think that should be the case?
Oh,
that
yes.
should be a requirement.
Right. So that the idea is that everybody would have some kind of health insurance plan. And then, of course, hospitals could then be deemed – the non-for-profit status could be done away with, and then hospitals could compete for patients like everybody else.
I want to go back to what you said, though, at the beginning, that you do believe that people in the United States should have access – to quality medical care.
Absolutely.
Does that make health care a right, at least, you know, basic health care, life-saving health care?
Well, I think it depends what you call a right. I think it's in society's interest that that happens. We want people as healthy as possible to be as productive as possible throughout their lives. So I say that it is in society's interest to do this. If you want to call it a right, that's fine. But I think it's easier to sell this to people as it's in your interest. Your standard of living will improve if everybody is productive as much as possible. So that's why I try to make it – I try to say it. It's in everybody's interest to do this, not some kind of moral directive.
The way I hear you talk about that, though, kind of reminds me of the history of the Kalamazoo school case. Where the question was, can there be publicly financed schools? And the opinion came back, yes, because it is in the interest of the community to have a well-educated populace. Is that the way maybe we should be trying to think about healthcare? It's in our interest that not only am I healthy, but my neighbors are healthy as well.
Well, to me, that's exactly correct. That is exactly correct. And so why should people pay taxes or provide enough tax funding so that everybody, if they wish, can have a tax credit to have one of these expanded health savings accounts with the high deductible plan. It's in your interest for everybody to be able to do this and let people choose. Let the market decide what people want. Give people choices. Isn't that the American way? Instead of trying to jam something down people's throats, which in turn is causing the courts to be filled with all these cases and all this rigmarole and fighting, I think it's kind of silly. I mean, just give people an alternative.
Ken Fisher is a Kalamazoo doctor. He's also the author of the e-book Understanding Healthcare, A Historical Perspective. Dr. Fisher, once again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon. It's a pleasure to be with you.
There's a link with more information about Ken Fisher's book at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Indianapolis 500 is one of the traditions of Memorial Day weekend, but 20 years ago, that race was run amid tragedy. Scott Brayton of Coldwater was killed in a practice days before the race was run. He had won the pole position at the Indy 500 for the second year in a row. Battle Creek Enquirer sports columnist Bill Broderick recently wrote about Scott Brayton, his legacy, and his family. Bill Broderick, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How big a star was Scott Brayton in racing circles at the time of his death?
Well, he was a huge star, and it had a lot to do with his sparkling personality and that smile, as his family talks about a little bit. He was magnetic and really a big crowd pleaser, but on the track alone, he was a big star himself. The back-to-back pole positions that you mentioned at the biggest race of the year, the Indy 500. He had been in 14 Indy 500s over his career. He had several top 10 finishes there. And just the Brayton family was big in those racing circles, because they were made motors for different cars, and that's how they kind of got into the Indy 500 originally. And Lee Brayton, the father of Scott, created those motors in Coldwater, and a lot of the drivers would use their engines to get an edge. And the main motor that Scott Brayton used was kind of the original, the V6 engine at the time, and kind of gave him an edge. And then that's kind of what made him a star in the sport at that time.
So what happened in this practice that led to his death?
Well, according to reports, and according to his dad, when I talked to him last week, it was just kind of a fluke thing. He blew out a tire and it went sideways into the wall. A lot of times you'll hit the wall nose first, or you'll hit the wall in a different style. But because he went sideways into the wall, there wasn't any way to cushion it a little bit. And then when he went sideways, his head slammed against the side of the wall at the very same time. So it wasn't like going forward, and so he didn't have any safety that way. So his head slammed sideways, and he was dead on impact there because of brain damage. His dad talked about how it didn't seem like that big of a crash at the time, because he'd been in some crashes himself, and he's gotten some worse crashes because of the way he hit the wall, and didn't rotate or didn't fly up in the air. But the fact that the way it hit it and at the angle that it hit it, that was really a fluke thing, and that's what caused his death.
And that seems to be something that sort of happens in auto racing, that sometimes the crashes that look the worst, drivers are able to walk away from, and sometimes a crash that doesn't seem to look quite as bad, at least from the vantage point of the television lens or from a long way away, are the ones that lead to serious injuries and sometimes death.
Exactly, and that was one of the interesting stories that his dad was telling me when he was recalling Scott. He was watching it, and he was there for the practice and for the warm-ups ahead of time, because he'd already won the pole position. And Scott was in his backup car, and his tire blew out, and he hit the wall. And then, people, of course, went over to see how he was. And when they put him in the ambulance kind of drove away, but it wasn't going all bells and whistles screaming down the racetrack. It was kind of going slow. So Dad at the time commented, well, he must have thought that he wasn't that bad because they weren't in any hurry. What he found out later was that he was already dead, and they weren't going to be able to do anything for him. So, but at the time, his dad mentioned that he had seen worse crashes, and he had been in worse crashes himself, and really didn't think that what happened to Scott had happened, but it did, and it was such a tragedy for family and for the racing community and for Coldwater.
Do his parents still live in Coldwater?
Yeah, they still own the engineering company, Brayton Engineering, in Coldwater still. They have offices down there, and when I visited them a couple weeks ago, they have pictures of Scott all around there, and they still make engines for some drivers off and on at different levels of the IndyCar racing. They are still involved in it. They go to Indy 500 most every year. They didn't go last year because of health, but they said they were coming this year. And they still enjoy the sport, and they watch it every year. And, when you start talking to them about what happened 20 years ago, of course, they get emotional, and that hits them pretty hard. But they still love the sport of Indy car racing and auto racing in general.
And you also caught up with the wife that Scott Brayton left behind. What is happening? And he also had a young daughter. So what can you tell us about them 20 years later?
Yeah, Becky Brayton was his longtime sweetheart from the area, and she came and worked with the Braytons for a long time and was involved with them for a long time here in Coldwater. And a couple of years after he died, she stayed in the Indy 500 racing community. She married another driver, Robbie Buell, and she kept her last name, Becky Brayton. She still brightens up when you talk to her about Scott. She doesn't like to talk too much about the accident, and really didn't with me at all. But she talks about Scott in general in glowing terms and what kind of a person he was and what kind of driver he was and his magnetic personality. And then when you bring up their daughter, she really glows about that. Carly at the time was only 2 years old, and there's some pictures of her at the funeral, a little girl running up, just seeing a picture of her dad there, and that kind of breaks your heart when you kind of think about that. And for a long time, she didn't really understand what was going on and really didn't want to talk about it. But from Becky, they say that she's 22 now, and she wants to know more about the person her dad was and his career, and she's involved in that. But they both live in Cleveland now, and they're still involved in racing.
And I found that interesting that all of these family members who lost someone so dear to them are still very tied into racing 20 years later. I guess I'm wondering, do people who are part of the racing community accept that there is just a certain level of risk that comes with the sport?
That's the impression I have. I asked them about that a couple times, and I guess that is, it'd be hard. It's hard for me to understand. Maybe it's hard for you or I to understand that you could still be around the track after something like that happened. But I think those people who are entrenched in auto racing realize there can be tragedy attached to it. And there are several deaths around Indy 500. I think I read a story just the other day, there's been 40 over the years. And it's just part of what happens in that sport. And I think people that are involved in it, and especially drivers and car owners and the people involved in the cars, really understand that more than anybody. And it's hard for me to relate to, but I think they kind of understand what's going on, and they take what it is and still love the sport. And of course, they still have memories of their loved ones.
Was it at all tough getting his parents or the woman he was married to at the time to talk about this? Were they at all reluctant to maybe go back over what have to be some very difficult memories from 20 years ago?
Yeah, it was. It wasn't hard at the time. I was a little surprised that that Lee Braden especially was open to Chad. I mean, I asked him, I caught up with him and said, can I come down and chat? And he said, fine. And at the time, I thought maybe it wasn't going to affect him as much because he was open to talking about it that quickly. I didn't have to do too much work. But once you start talking to them, you realize that they still are attached to that situation and they are emotional about that. So that's understandable. And I got that from him a little bit. I think a little bit of the background helped out a little bit. The reason why the story kind of came up for me was that, and I knew about it maybe ahead of the Indy 500 before some news was coming around and some of this historical data was coming around, was because that was the first story I worked on here at the Battle Creek Inquirer back on the very first day that I arrived in the office was the day of that crash. So I was thrown out of that story and talked to some people in Coldwater about that. And ever since then, I've been kind of connected to that day in my career, and it's been top of mind in terms of when that has happened and when the Indy 500 kind of comes around every year. I think about Scott Braden and what he meant to the community of racing and what he meant to the community of Coldwater.
So if you could maybe sort of take those different interviews that you did and maybe synthesize them, what are maybe a couple things that you think his parents and Becky Braden would want people to know about Scott Braden, how they would like him to be remembered?
Well, it kept coming back to me every time we're talking about him, and every little story was his, and I think I mentioned this before, his magnetic personality, his smile. He really drew people in that way, and you can see that in a lot of the pictures from those days. But then Becky also commented about his determination on the track and then not wanting to lose, and his mom said that more than a couple of times also about how he was just a determined individual to succeed no matter what they were doing, and it was just that aspect of him probably what led him to be such a great driver.
Bill Broderick, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thanks, I appreciate it.
Battle Creek Inquirer sports columnist Bill Broderick wrote about how Coldwater native Scott Braden is remembered 20 years after the crash at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that took the auto racer's life. You can find his column at battlecreekinquirer.com. There's also a link at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.